It's the Wired UK podcast, episode 97 for Friday, the 12th of October, 2012. This week, we're going to be drilling into the story about a billion-dollar plan to drill into the Earth's mantle. Plus, could a non-profit pornography website really function to raise money for charity? One company's trying to make that happen, and an actor has been sued for looking too much like himself in an advert. WTF, you might say. All that and oodles more coming up as we drill through the crust of Planet Wired and extract the very best of the week's Wired news rock. Ahoy hoy, Nate Langson here, of course, and I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, associate editor, Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
And associate, no, an editorial assistant, actually, David Cornish.
Hi there.
Hi, I've also dragged another intern into the room. His name's James. James, shout hello.
Hello.
That's a bit of James action right there. 2 weeks in a row, this is a new record for me in recent weeks.
I know. Oh, wow, my voice is breaking.
Hello.
Sorry about that.
You've been giving a talk.
I've been giving a talk. Now I'm going to just lose my voice or just turn into a man.
Yes. That's a shame. Well, why don't we crack on with something that some men and women are doing. There's a billion-dollar mission to drill into the Earth's mantle, David. This is frightening in the greatest sense.
Yes, it is. Hopefully they're not going to make a massive hole in the ocean and all of the seas will plunge into it. No, a team of scientists from the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program are set to embark on a billion-dollar expedition to drill, as you say, into the Earth's mantle layer and make history by collecting the first ever mantle samples. Now, the mantle layer is a 3,000-kilometre thick area that makes up 84% of our planet.
That's a lot of planet.
It's a lot of planet, and it sits just below the Earth's crust, which itself is a big, nice, crusty layer of continental plates that range between 35 kilometres and 70 kilometres in thickness, and oceanic basins, which are between 5 to 10 kilometres.
Hang on. Isn't this just the plot of that terrible movie, The Core?
It might well be. I haven't.
We are going to drill to the centre of the Earth, and then they want to kickstart the movement of the mantle, I think.
If you say it is.
Well, they've had some time to plan it,
yes,
haven't they?
Anyway.
Moving on.
Back to the Integrated Ocean Drilling Program have selected three possible locations in the Pacific Ocean where the crust is actually nice and thin, so they've got less work to do. They plan to drill 6 kilometres down into the mantle from a Japanese deep-sea drilling vessel called the Chikyu. I think that's how. What do you say? The Chikyu? It sounds very sweet, but no, he's there to do a very important mission. Once the drilling equipment, so this is, yeah, the entire way that they're going to do this is very complicated. So once the drilling equipment is successfully lowered through 4 kilometres of ocean water, like moving about and being all nice and fluid, they then have to secure it to the bottom of the ocean. They will then set about drilling a 30-centimetre hole through the ocean basin. And then
it's 30 centimetre wide.
30 centimetre wide. Sorry, kilometres out, 30 centimetre wide. And they will then just keep drilling until they get to mantle layer. Every 50 to 60 hours, though, they will have to replace the drill bits on the head of the drill because that's just how quickly it gets used up.
That happens in drilling for oil as well, though, same kind of mechanism.
Yeah, but this is going farther down than anyone's ever been before.
Yeah.
And to get mantle rock.
I feel like this isn't a good idea. I mean, are we not just like popping an enormous spot by doing this?
I don't think it's going to be a case that all of the mantle will suddenly rush out.
No.
No, because it's just rock.
Yeah, but molten rock.
Molten rock.
Still rock.
Okay.
Either way, they are saying, well, the project co-leader, Damon Teagle of the University of Southampton, he's bigging it up, because he would, but he's saying it's going to be a very big expedition. He's likened it, these are his words of describing the process. It will be the equivalent of dangling a steel string the width of a human hair in the deep end of a swimming pool and inserting it into a thimble a tenth of a millimetre wide on the bottom and then drilling a few metres into the foundations. I've not tried to do that.
No.
I had a little experiment in the bath the other day, but it seems
pretty tricky.
It sounds tough. And what's the actual goal of all this? I mean, it all sounds wonderfully, science, fantasy, fiction, but reality. But they're trying to do it to understand earthquakes and things, I think.
They are indeed. Basically, we've never been down to the mantle before. We don't know that much about it, despite the fact it makes up 84% of our planet's mass. So they are hoping that if we can get some mantle samples, we'll be able to understand a little bit more about this massive part of the Earth so we can find out more about continental drift, earthquakes and volcanoes.
We don't know when it's going to start, though, yet.
No.
They're just starting planning at the moment.
Not a clue. They still need to make a lot more money. But they're hopeful if they get the cash, they could start drilling before the end of the decade.
Wow. Well, I've already made a planet pun.
Yeah.
I can't think of one to go with Earth. Well, we'll just leave it there then in that case and move swiftly on to non-profit pornography, Liv. Ethically yes. inspired pornography. And we'll yes. try and be as tasteful with this as possible, but if there are any very, very little children in the room, then they might want to just plug their ears with a sock.
Yes, I think they might do.
What's the dealio, Liv?
Well, this is a new site called Come For. That's for the number as opposed to the word. And it's a site that aims to plough all its advertising revenue and sponsorship revenue into ethical causes. So the porn itself isn't necessarily ethically inspired. It's not about, you know, sexy dolphins or pandas, you know, who
that'd
are,
be a very, very weird brand of pornography.
Yeah, you know, like,
and illegal.
Well, yes, exactly. So what happens is it's a regular porn site. It's very kind of tastefully designed. So actually, it's not a regular porn site. It's kind of quite it's going for the design focus. Okay. And visitors can upload and share and watch sexually explicit materials. And this can range from just artistic nudes through to homemade videos. Now, it's been created by a pair of Italian guys. One's called Marco Annoni and the other one's Riccardo Zilli. And what they've said is that, you know, the porn industry is such a vast, vast industry. I think it's worth $100 billion globally. And so they hope to be able to siphon off just a very small amount of this and use that money for good causes. What they say is that the porn industry as it exists doesn't really reflect the kind of natural plurality of sexuality in society. I mean, it tends to be very like one dimensional, have a perspective that can sometimes be quite fake and kind of male centric. And they say in some cases barely legal. So what they want to do is kind of critically reassess the relationship between porn and society and try and find a way that, you know, you can enjoy yourself while also contributing to a good cause.
And they're not intending to profit from this, are they, either?
No, it's a not-for-profit site. They're currently, they haven't built it. They're trying to raise money on a crowdfunding site called Ululi, which I hadn't heard of before, but it's like a Kickstarter sort of thing. So I guess it's a kind of interesting idea. If you accept that pornography isn't inherently bad, there's just a lot of bad pornography out there, then it shouldn't be a conflict to be able to use the money generated from watching that pornography for good causes. But I do think there might be a few issues with certain charitable causes.
Yeah, there will definitely be charities that exist that wouldn't want to accept money off something like this, in the same way that I know I've joked in the past that it would make a lot of sense for somebody like Google to advertise on toilet paper.
Yeah.
Because they've got someone's undivided attention for a small amount of time, but no one's probably going to want to have their brand and company name on something that's going to be used, well, you know.
Exactly. And I was thinking, you know, many, many kind of women's causes sort of charities probably would feel uncomfortable with this, accepting money from anything like this. But there is, they do already have a charity that signed up to accept money. It's a disability charity. And, you know, I think, why not? If people are watching pornography anyway, why not put that money to a good cause rather than the kind of, you know, other companies that they're currently already getting the money for? You know, why not plough it into charities so you can feel good when you are feeling good?
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. That could be their strap line.
I also like it's two Italian guys. I think it's something to do with deep Catholic guilt. They've come up with an amazing way of being able to shed this Catholic guilt.
Yeah.
That's an interesting take. Okay, well, this site hasn't launched yet, I don't think, but they're raising some money on a Kickstarter type program, aren't they? Right.
Yes.
That you mentioned.
They're raising money. And once they've done that, I think they're going to just launch it in the next couple of months.
Fair enough. Well, let's go into space. Another method of combating the growing threat of space junk has been proposed. And this one, Liv, David, involves harpoons, which makes it inherently exciting. It's a project from a UK space company called Astrium, and they have proposed the idea of developing space harpoons, which would be launched from satellites that chase orbiting debris that's littering the space around the Earth. Already you should have a fairly exciting mental image, although as a slight tangent, just before I get into this, found out the other day that when that giant asteroid hit the Earth and blew the dinosaurs out of existence, yeah, it actually blew dinosaurs into orbit.
How do we know that?
I heard it on a podcast the other day.
Have they found like a dinosaur skeleton, like orbiting Mars?
Well, I think they probably plummeted back into the atmosphere before too long and burnt up. And that's why there aren't any T-Rexes or T-Rai, as I like to call them, floating around the ISS. But I thought that's quite fun.
I'd like to know how they know that. But yes, I like the mental image of them floating around.
Anyway, so the space harpoons, these would be about 30 centimetres long each and would target bits of old satellite, you know, metal objects. We're not talking about bits of rock, like kind of, you know, a satellite that may have crashed into another satellite and the remains are just floating around. And it would be monitored by a team on Earth who would chase the debris, and they would have a live video feed on the front of this little traveling harpoon machine, and would send the 30-centimeter long harpoon into the debris, pull it out of its orbit, or at least knock it off its trajectory, so that it eventually hurls into the atmosphere and burns up. I think that's a really great solution to a space junk issue.
It is, but can I just say, space junk seems to inspire the most extraordinary machines. I mean,
well, it's a huge problem as well. It's and it's a growing problem. I think there's like 1,000 satellites up there or something, but 20-something thousand bits of debris that are bigger than the size of a cup.
Yeah, but we've talked about so many weird and wonderful solutions to this space junk. I mean, there are things like robots going out and grabbing it.
Well, there are some
lasers.
Yeah, I mean, there's some really other ones. Yeah, there's some like high-powered lasers that basically literally blast debris into bits. There was one proposer of a floating sticky boom arm that attracts junk with like just electro-adhesive, sort of, you know, kind of like a big magnet, I guess. And Boeing recently filed a patent for a system that sends satellites into orbit that are filled with gases that can be sprayed onto a target that slows them down so it eventually plummets into the atmosphere.
It's very creative.
But it's a really necessary thing. I mean, with, you know, we're now in the industry of space tourism. We've got Sarah Brightman, we reported about this week, who is taking a trip to the ISS with Virgin Galactic or someone.
No, she's going up with the Russian cosmonauts on space tours.
She's trying to escape Andrew Lloyd Webber even further.
I like Sarah Brightman, actually.
I think she's good as well.
Yeah.
I don't know why she's going to space.
Why not? Why not?
Okay, we could go on forever.
Let's not. but it is a real problem. With all these, you know, we've got SpaceX that's docking with the ISS to deliver resupplies, and, you know, and that's now a privately funded thing as opposed to NASA doing it. Like, this is just an ever more increasing problem. We've basically got to tackle this now before it becomes a really serious restriction on future space industries and things like that.
I want to be the first guy who puts his name now to be a space bin man. I could happily be a space bin man.
I think they'd probably give it a showier title, wouldn't they?
I think they just need a giant net.
Yes.
Huge.
Why have
net,
they not thought of this, Nate?
A huge net in orbit, just picking up bits of space junk. You know,
I prefer the idea of harpooning all forms of trash and rubbish everywhere we are now. Why just leave this for space? I want to harpoon my bin bags back home now.
I agree. Well, we can all harpoon David Cameron more socially now because. Well, firstly, he's joined Twitter. And secondly, there's a report that has offered MPs guidelines on how to use social media in a more effective way. David, you've been writing about this.
I have indeed. I have. Yeah, I've been looking into this. The research group Parliament Street, who write papers to try and influence government and big thinkers, they have come out with a report examining how MPs engage with their voters via Twitter. They believe that voter apathy, which is in a really bad state, well, we were always looking quite apathetic at the Westminster and any kind of election that comes along. The last one, the 2012 local elections, only 32% of the country actually bothered to turn up and vote.
I think that's quite high.
It's been on the slump. Still, I mean, 32% is pretty. I'm not that happy.
It's less than half of the country having all the say.
Yeah, far less.
Yes, far less.
A third, in fact. Yeah, well, basically, they believe that voter apathy could be partly cured if politicians took to communicating with voters on a medium that would reach larger audiences, because apparently TV and radio and press isn't enough. So they're going to turn to Twitter. The problem is, though, that MPs don't seem to be that good at using social media such as Twitter. Only 331 MPs actually had Twitter at the start of 2012. And as we've just said, the Prime Minister has only joined up to Twitter this week himself. So he's not setting a very good precedent at all.
He's not. And I think I can understand why, you know, an older politician, perhaps, who hasn't necessarily had to deal with this for his, you know, career thus far, would be nervous about suddenly being exposed to the internet
to
and
democracy
very frequently opinionated people.
Exactly, rightly so. I think we do need to be careful about who we say should just suddenly start spurting out on Twitter. They could get themselves in deep trouble.
But this is to address that, basically, right?
Yes, this is this report was to address that. So Parliament Street commissioned the group Yatterbox to provide data on all of the MPs who used Twitter in the month of September. And they then identified the top tweeting MPs and analysed their tweeting skills to see how they could help other MPs to improve. Parliament Street, having looked at all of these tweeting MPs, determined that the most successful MP cities followed four basic rules. Firstly, they updated their Twitter account very regularly. Secondly, they retweeted and answered questions from their constituents when possible. Thirdly, they offered links to campaigns and groups that they were associated with. And fourthly, possibly most importantly, they maintained a funny and normal persona on their account.
So it's not about being a robot.
No.
Thank you for your tweet. I will consider this.
Precisely.
Cheers. Good thoughts. Yeah.
But you can see why they'd be reluctant to do this. I mean, there have been so many twit storms where politicians have said something out of line and then it's been blown out of all proportion and then they get kind of, the whip then puts them into serious trouble. I think you can see why they'd be nervous about this, and sometimes it might just be better that they avoid it altogether, in
exactly.
my opinion.
There was, both Diane Abbott, who came out with a rather unfortunate comment in January of this year. She landed herself in a lot of trouble, as did Aidan Burley, who the Tory MP who came out with a rather unflattering description of the Olympic opening ceremony.
Yes.
Those are the sort of examples that you'd hope that MPs would want to avoid. And yet saying that...
No, but I'm glad that they do, because it means you get to see who the hell you're voting for. It's not going through the... Rant incoming. It's not about going through an incredibly controlling PR filter where everything is, incredibly monitored and everything's
boring.
Checked and triple checked and is cleared by everyone in the party. And then it finally goes out as a formal press release that everyone ignores because they know it's so incredibly vacuous and not representative of what they're actually wanting to say. This means that they can just stand up and say what they say. And if they get drunk and say something that they shouldn't have said, then fair dues, because they may
on
get
their
drunk
head, be
and say yes to something they should say no to. So I think it's a good thing that members of parliament get into trouble sometimes like this, and it's a good lesson that really we're just moving into a more democratized state way of communicating with each other, and MPs should be a part of that.
I wholeheartedly agree. I like the fact as well that Twitter might actually allow us constituents to see that our MPs are people, that they can come out with opinions that are their own. And then we can help inform our own opinions on them and whether we want to vote for them next time around.
But you know what I'm upset about is that David Cameron has used the underscore. David underscore Cameron.
A classic Solonican trait.
Yes. There. And I'm a little bit concerned that we're going to be somehow more affiliated than we already are, which is not at all.
Mm. Well, that's Cameron of you, David. I'm on farm today.
You're knocking them out of the park.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this is a really great move. I think this can only be good for democracy, certainly. Mm. And I think that, the more MPs we get tweeting and being on Facebook and not understanding how to use it best, perhaps the more of their natural selves we will see in the public eye. Sony has sued an actor who played a character in a PlayStation advert for looking too similar to himself in a new advert for another company. It's a bit bizarre, actually. The guy's name is Jerry Lambert, and he played the role of office manager type person Kevin Butler in a series of PlayStation 3 ads between 2009 and 2011. These became pretty popular. The Butler character became, they felt synonymous with the PlayStation brand. But the actor, Lambert, finished working on the campaigns with Sony and was hired to play another office manager character type, but this time for the tire company Bridgestone. And in this advert, he was using a Nintendo Wii console, which is competitor to the PlayStation. So Sony has filed a lawsuit that says, and here's a quote, "We invested significant resources in bringing the Kevin Butler character to life, and he's become an iconic personality directly associated with PlayStation products over the years. Use of the Kevin Butler character to sell products other than those from PlayStation misappropriates Sony's intellectual property, creates confusion in the market, and causes damage to Sony." Which is such a weird
It suggests that people can't understand that actors are playing characters and are in different shows.
But according to the Hollywood Reporter, the reason why the case is actually going ahead is because Lambert had had an exclusivity clause in his contract that specifically prevented him from using his likeness
in ads
for a competing gaming system like Nintendo, despite the fact that the ad in question is actually for a car tire company.
Yeah, it's a bit of a stretch, I think, to try and say, well, there's a Nintendo in it, and so there's a sort of an association, but actually it's for a tire company. I don't think they've got a very strong case, to be honest.
No, Bridgestone quite naturally has responded and said that their commercial doesn't feature Kevin Butler, but just the actor who played Butler, Jerry Lambert, which I think makes a great deal of sense. The company said in a quote, Mr. Lambert is one of the actors who appeared in the commercial as a Bridgestone engineer. Bridgestone denies that Kevin Butler appears in the Bridgestone commercial discussed herein and thus denies that he speaks or does anything whatsoever in the commercial. It's like, it's not Butler, it's the dude who played him.
I mean, if this case went through, it would mean that any movie that ever contained actors who only play one character, any movie studio with who had a movie with Hugh Grant or Jason Statham would be able to sue each other because he's playing the same character in different movies.
It's like being sued for being typecast. It's like, you know, kicking you when you're down. I know there was one of the actors who played Doctor Who in one of the reboot series who only did it for one season. And he turned it down for the second and third season onwards because, like, I don't want to be typecast. You know, but it's like, you know, whenever, say, Matthew Perry shows up. I was watching Scrubs the other day and Matthew Perry was in Scrubs. I was like, oh, it's Chandler from Friends. I didn't know he was in Scrubs.
Sue Scrubs.
Quickly, sue whoever did it. NBC, was it? CBS? I can't remember. So it's a bit bizarre, and obviously Bridgestone is going to proceed with the case and deny it, and I wouldn't be surprised if they win, but
yeah,
very, very bizarre. Should a real character be forever contractually tied to not play similar characters under trademark law? I don't know. Email us, podcast@wired.co.uk. You can find this story with the two videos in it if you want to see the comparison. If you go to wired.co.uk, search Sony ad actor, you will find the story. While you pull that up, we're going to go for a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to find out an interesting way directors are trying to get people back into the cinema to see the same film for a second time.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
David.
Hello, sir.
Mr. Cornish, you wrote a story this year that piqued my interest.
Oh, good.
Yes, because it's something that I've thought has been a good idea for quite a while, and someone's actually doing it. Why don't you tell us about the Looper director?
Well, I think this is a cracking idea. The director and writer of the current film Looper, Rian Johnson, has come up with a novel way of getting people back into the cinema to see his film for a second time, or loop their experience. So Johnson, what he has done, he has released a downloadable audio commentary for audience members to listen to while watching the film for a second time. Basically, he's already done this once. It's not a completely new ploy. Johnson, he actually tried it first time round for his 2008 film, The Brothers Bloom, which I have to confess I haven't seen. But some people have seen twice, because basically his fan base wrote into him and said, we like this so much, but we'd like to know your thoughts on it, and we can't wait for the DVD release, so can you give us an audio commentary that we can use?
And the great thing is that, I mean, this has been done by movie fan websites for some time, where you can just, they record their voices while watching the film, you press play at the same time, and there's no sort of copyright issue there, because all they're actually downloading is them talking about a film in a review context, and you just press play at the same time, and it's great. But this directly benefits cinema releases, movie studio, what do you call them? Cinemas,
those things.
They're just dying. Yeah.
Remember those?
Cinemas should perhaps do this as a way of getting people into their films. They could give out an iPod or something with it loaded and could say, come back, or see it twice and get the audio commentary and whatever.
I guess the only issue is you go to the cinema for that kind of really immersive experience, and they have these amazing sound systems that, you know, 3D sound. And so to kind of replace that with the just director chatting feels like you might be slightly cheated.
But think about it. If you put your little iPod earbuds in, you're still hearing all the sound. Because it's not like you're putting sound isolating headphones designed for use on a plane or something.
Yeah.
Like, you're still going to hear it, even if it's just like in one ear, like a translator or something. Or when you go on a tour guide around Stonehenge.
Well, Johnson urges, actually, he says this implicitly on, it all came out on Looper's Tumblr account. He wants people to only use this for their second viewing purposes. Mm. He really wants people to go in, have the full immersive experience the first time around, and should you love it so much and become a bit of a fanboy for the film, he wants you to go again with the audio commentary. He explains that it's a totally different commentary from the track that will be appearing on the Blu-ray and DVD release.
Well, now
so
it
he's
is.
Offering. Yeah, now it is, yeah. So he goes into a bit more technical and detailed information. I had a listen to it. It's not the fullest of commentaries. There are many sequences where there's a bit of silence, but when everything picks up, he can come in with his own view that helps you appreciate that scene that little bit more.
Now, you've seen Looper already.
I have indeed.
Would you want to go back and watch it again with the audio track?
I would. It's the sort of film that I think it's a layered film.
Maybe
it's
they could layers. Comment on Joseph Gordon-Levitt's mouth area. And it's,
yeah, and many other things.
Playing Bruce Willis.
For those who haven't seen the film, Jason Gordon-Levitt is a looper. It's set in a world in which time travel has been invented, but it's immediately outlawed. So the only people who use it are the mob and gangs who, you know, nasty men like that. And if they ever want to bump somebody off or kill them, they send them back in time in order for some hired gun to kill them in the past. So, you know, their hands are clean of it. Now, Jason Gordon-Levitt's character... Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character is one such looper. And basically his world gets all turned upside down when his next target happens to be his older self, played by Bruce Willis.
I
won't do any spoilers, but
the plot thickens exactly. Like an old cream.
But he had to spend 3 hours in makeup before every day of shooting in order that they could add like a false nose and the bits of his lips
and immobilize the lower part of his face.
Yeah, just so he could look a little bit more like Bruce Willis. But it's worth seeing. I think it works really well because you realize that Bruce Willis doesn't use a lot of his face in his tough man acting. It's all in the eyebrow and the stare, and he's very much immobile from the nose down. But
thanks for that recap of a film. That was great. You know, everyone should go and pay to see Looper two or three
definitely
times
should.
With a commentary. And I think that cinemas could take this and really run with it. And they could even broadcast 4 or 5 different audio commentaries in the cinema and give a device that can switch between the different channels. So you could tune into maybe a cast commentary or a fan commentary or a director commentary.
I love the idea of having the little chuckles from listening to the commentary are completely separate from the chuckles from the actual movie.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Or we could just wait until the DVD comes out and then have the audio commentary on that.
In the 21st century, waiting is becoming a thing of the past. Everyone has a feeling of digital entitlement. That's why you're not broadcasting this on the same day as the US. Hello, BitTorrent. Goodbye, sales. Yeah. Because everyone feels if it's available anywhere, it should be available everywhere. And to be fair, it should. But that's
another rant.
Discussion for a future rant, yes. We've got one more thing I want to come to, because we had a story on the site this week about the strangest things that people have proposed putting on the moon. We were sort of talking a lot about the strangest ways of drilling into the planet, and this kind of is slightly tangentially linked to that in as much as we're looking at the moon and not the Earth. But I thought we could go through a few things and talk about how mad we think they are, or how realistic they may be in the future. The first thing that has been once proposed to be put on the moon is a NASCAR race. There's a company called Space Systems Laurel, who came up with kind of an extraterrestrial backup center named the Lunar Data Cache in 2004. And they had a few creative ways to fund this project, and they were mainly centered on spectacles like robot NASCAR races on the moon or robot rock heaving contests, robot wrestling.
This is just ridiculous. This is pure PR puffery in my view. This is like, we've got a company, we want to make a name for ourselves, let's pretend we're going to build a race on the moon.
Yeah, well, he wasn't the only one, actually. There was a Newt Gingrich, I think, earlier this year or last year, is a bit of a space enthusiast, and said in a talk in Florida that he promises to have a US moon base by 2020, and once the lunar outpost had enough residents, he would claim it and as a basically apply for statehood, making the moon the 51st US state, which would be done under frontiersman laws or something when settlers claimed parts of the American West or whatever.
Oh, God.
Well, they've already got a flag up there.
That makes more sense to me than the race. I mean, that's the kind of thing you can imagine would happen, but actually, the race is just ridiculous.
Another one which should come as no surprise, and I think possibly was parodied on Futurama at some point, is to use the moon as a giant billboard. Coca-Cola is one company that's considered using technology to basically put a Coke logo on the side of the moon so that when people look up to the sky, they see an advert for Coca-Cola.
Does that mean on the dark side of the moon there'd be a Diet Coke advert?
That'd be Pepsi.
Oh, of course.
I wonder how much it would cost to advertise on the moon.
A lot of
money. Who's going to sell that media space? Condé Nast needs to get all over that.
A lot of money. That'd be a great place to put a Wired ad, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
New issue out now.
On the moon.
on the moon.
Read it with your binoculars.
Yes. I'll put a giant QR code up there and get everyone to put their cameras to the sky.
No QR codes.
You know. Actually, you could do that with planes. If you think about that, when there's apps now that show you, if you put your app up to the sky on your camera, it shows you where the planes that you can see are flying from and to.
Yeah.
If you put like QR codes on the bottom and a giant zoom lens, you could say, scan the underside of my plane for a discount at BA or something.
Probably McDonald's. Why? QR codes need to die a painful death.
Yes, they do. They stand for quite ridiculous. And no one really seems to like them except ad execs. Okay, another thing that could be done is a lift, like a moon lift. And there have been a number of proposals to construct lifts where one side is tethered to the moon and another one is tethered to the Earth. A recent one came from a company called Liftport. And this would allow people and materials to travel from Earth to space without the need for things like space rockets necessarily. They would just get in and it would be, you know, you would go to the moon.
Every time I hear about these lifts, I don't know why, but the first image that comes into my mind is of standing on an escalator and on a really, really long escalator and just like, I don't know, reading the Metro or whatever you do.
I've got this awful image of this giant tunnel coming down from space, and no one's taken into consideration the fact that the Earth moves and the moon moves.
Oh, yeah.
So you've just got the giant tunnel suddenly heading towards a massive capital city and everybody, why didn't we think of this first?
Yeah.
Well, the one of the last things in our list is to just put a mine up there and let's just start mining the moon. It's thought that there are minerals up there, metals, helium-3, that could be used for fusion reactors and stuff. And people have proposed the moon as a potential target for mining, which could be quite interesting.
What would you put on the moon?
Me? What would I put up there?
I'd put Justin Bieber up there.
Okay.
Good. Oh, he's an easy target.
Very.
Yeah.
I think you could put him, you could not waste the energy and money getting him up there. You could probably get him just like a few hundred meters in the ground and then
Only a one-way trip. Fine.
Fair enough.
I would put
Putting Sarah Goodman on the ISS, for goodness sake. We might as well think
Brightman.
About it. Brightman, sorry, not Goodman.
I would put a giant mirror on the side of the moon so you could look up at it through a telephoto lens and see yourself looking back.
You know what? That would be amazing. And that was the most incredible thing about the blue marble picture was it was the first time that we actually got to look back on ourselves was when they took the picture of the blue marble it wasn't the ISS.
There was one taken on the Apollo landing.
Yeah.
And they took a photo of the Earth rise. It's a very famous photo.
And I think that's a nice idea.
Mm. Apart from the fact when if the sun ever caught it at such an angle that it did the magnifying thing and there was a tiny spot and then it suddenly, oh no, we've just eradicated the
entire Earth. Solve your problem of drilling to the mantle.
It would, yeah.
And I think that did happen in Futurama.
Yeah, probably has.
Yeah. Well, what would you like to put on the moon? email us, podcast@wired.co.uk, or add a message on our wall, facebook.com/wiredUK. We look forward to your feedback. I look forward to ending the podcast, Liv. Why don't you remind people of what I just said about how they can get in touch?
You just told people how to get in touch.
Tell them again.
Okay, well, you can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK, and we also have a fantastic Facebook page. We're on facebook.com/WiredUK, and you can always email us, podcast@wired.co.uk.
Thanks, Liv.
Thanks.
It's good. Repetition is the key to success.
Is it?
Yes, it's one of the many keys.
Okay.
It's a very capable lock is success, and there are many keys to it.
Excellent.
That is one of them.
Should we wrap up this podcast?
Let's do. David, Liv, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank
you,
Nate.
See you next week.
Bye. I'm really in a nuts stage at the moment
in
my life.
Today call you Nutkin.
Okay.